Hello and welcome to Cardo's debate number 20. Today we will be looking at the planetary health approach that focuses on the connection between environmental and human health, an important topic in times of climate change and in the middle of a pandemic, also for an emergency response organization like Cardo's. For those of you who tune in for the first time to our debate series, a few words about Cardo's. We are an international humanitarian aid organization, mainly active in the so-called Middle East and at Europe's outer borders. In Berlin, we run the Crisis Response Makerspace, which you can see in the background now. Here, we develop and construct equipment for our projects. And before the pandemic, we also held our discussion series here. At the moment, unfortunately, we cannot sit together with all of you in the Makerspace, but you can participate and ask questions via the chat or Twitter. You can see the address directly in the stream, or you can find it on our website, which is cardos.org/debate. I'm Corinna from Cardos, and it is my pleasure to now introduce to you my guest, Joe Middleton. Joe is a disease ecologist and research fellow at the Brighton and Sussex Medical School in the UK. They have a clinical background in emergency medical care and are presently working on projects integrating health and conservation with indigenous people. Joe is involved with such a project in Papua New Guinea, PNG for short, and has also been working on health-related topics with European migrant populations. And now, welcome Joe, and over to you.
Great. Well, thank you for inviting me to do the talk. So, as Corinna says, today I'll be talking about planetary health approaches to zoonotic spillover, indigenous health and rainforest conservation. And obviously we're in the middle of a pandemic now, and very much the focus is on transmission chains within our cities, how the disease is expanding, what the political reasons for kind of, you know, bad responses are. And that's all important stuff, but what I'm going to be focusing on today when I discuss zoonotic diseases is very much where they spill over from animal populations, from areas of deforestation, etc. So right at the beginning of the process, rather than, you know, out, you know, in the widespread pandemic that we're seeing now. And I'll also be talking about how those issues around zoonotic spillover interface with how we can protect indigenous health and also carry out rainforest conservation. So I'll be starting by talking about some of the science and some of the history about how diseases spill over. And then I'll be going straight into how we can take action at the forest frontier, especially to kind of prevent these pandemics from happening rather than waiting to respond to them once they're here. And finally, I'll be talking through some kind of ethical considerations, some problems involved with the general approach, and also just, you know, some caution about the evidence base for it. So that's what I'm going to be talking about today. So the whole talk is really framed within this idea of planetary health, which aims to safeguard both human health and the natural systems that underpin it. Now, planetary health is a kind of scientific field, but it's very much a movement within medicine. It's quite new, about 6 years old, and it's already started to really grab a lot of attention and pace and mobilize a lot of people within medicine. To think about protecting natural systems and understanding the connections between the wider environment and human health. And really, they started with this report from The Lancet, which is the world's leading Safeguarding Human Health in the Anthropocene Epoch. And this report very clearly laid out what the relationship between our industrial civilization is and ecological change and then emerging diseases, etc. So I'm not going to be reading lots of text in this talk, but I will just read this one key bit right at the beginning to kind of contextualize it. So in the planetary health report, they say, by almost any measure, human health is better now than any time in history. Life expectancy has soared from 47 years to 69 years, and death rates in children younger than 5 years of age have decreased substantially. But these gains in human health have come at a high price, the degradation of nature's ecological systems on a scale never seen in human history. And this has significant implications for human health in turn. So as a commission, they concluded that the continuing degradation of natural systems threatens to reverse the health gains seen over the last century, In short, we've mortgaged the health of future generations to realise economic and development gains in the present. And this planetary health perspective, looking at the relationship between the effects of our industrial civilization through the environment on returning health problems, is now an increasingly way that lots of people within medicine are understanding these new challenges. So we're going to really talk today about wildlife health and kind of zoonotic diseases and what we can do on the ground as basically mostly small aid organizations. Obviously the planetary health also looks at climate change and things like that's effect on human health as well. But today we're going to be focused on zoonotic diseases and indigenous health. So in the Anthropocene, wildlife health and human health are deeply connected. So 75% of emerging infectious diseases are zoonotic. So they emerge from animal populations and cross over into people. And this is also bad news for quite a lot of wildlife, as they're often threatened by culls to protect human health. And we're used increasingly, especially with COVID, to understanding about zoonotic diseases, diseases which travel from animals to humans. We also have anthropognotic diseases, which where you get unhealthy human communities, are disease reservoir threats to wildlife. So actually, we're a very large amount of the total kind of mammalian mass now on Earth. And so we're harbouring lots of diseases which are a threat to species of conservation concern. So let's think how, first of all, kind of pandemic diseases spread. So, and this is true for, roughly speaking, for the COVID-19 pandemic as well. So starting at the bottom, we have a large amount of pathogens circulating in wild populations especially. And out there, you know, it's estimated there's about 1.5 million viruses which are likely to be pathogenic to humans if they spilled over that have been identified or theorized in certain settings. So we're talking about a very large amount of biodiverse kind of pathogen threats to humans, and they're circulating in wildlife. Now, as you get encroachment into wildlife habitat, changes in land use, which I'll be talking about, then you see those diseases spill over into domestic animals. And then after a while, that can spread to humans, and you might get a local outbreak. So, for instance, Ebola virus outbreak or Nipah, and I'll be talking about Ebola as well as HIV a bit later. Now, these can be localized emergencies which stay in the immediate area, and this is happening quite a lot all over, especially the global south, but very rarely reaches us in terms of the news. When, of course, international travel makes these local outbreaks become global pandemics, as we're seeing with COVID-19, then we're in full pandemic emergence, kind of stage three on this diagram. And that's true for HIV/AIDS and severe acute respiratory syndrome, SARS-1, which predated SARS-2. So I'm going to be talking about this situation where the spillover happens at tropical rainforests. And in ecology, we talk about this kind of zone between two ecological systems as an ecotone. This is a kind of transitionary space between, for instance, a forest and agriculture. And through that kind of field boundary, you can imagine lots of humans and domestic animals going into wild environments, and also wild animals such as bats, etc., crossing over into agricultural land. And when you see the way that we're developing global landscapes, we're increasingly fragmenting what wild land there is left. And if you look at the diagrams at the bottom, you can see the unfragmented large circles have relatively little edge, but when we fragment them, even if we keep the same area, they have a lot more edge, and that edge is a space through which diseases can spill over into the surrounding human society. And that's exactly what we've been seeing with recent pandemics. So if in ecology we talk about the space between two environments as being an ecotone, that kind of transitionary space moving from one habitat to another, actually we have another term called chronotones, which is worth thinking about, which is like an ecotone but in time. So what we're seeing now globally is a massive shift, a systems shift, from one state with high biodiverse ecosystems to another state with much more simplified ecosystems under kind of human management. And so that rapid change, that moment of shift between the two states, is itself where we're going to see a lot of disease spillover. And we start with kind of large forests with, you know, a very large amount of animals. And as we get more fragmented, we see the number of species diminish further until we end up with a very small number of species left in habitats. And these species are disproportionately small animals, which invest a lot in reproduction rather than immunity, and are much more likely to be carrying pathogens for humans, and also can just simply tolerate human-dominated environments. And so it's from these species, bats, rodents, etc., we're seeing a lot of disease spillover. And this is happening within the context of what can only be talked about as a biological annihilation of the ecological systems and species on Earth. So it's within this kind of ecological context that we need to understand why these pandemic threats, including COVID-19, are happening. So here's a prediction from 2012 of where the next pandemic zoonoses globally will happen. And as you can see, if you look in China and India, we can see it's very red, marked as high risk. This is because of the scale of landscape change and also because of dense human populations and the wildlife trade. If you look across the equator, more generally, where there's lots of red, for instance, in Africa or in Indonesia, that's where we're seeing massive forest change due to deforestation and commercial logging for global commodity demands. But actually, there's also red up in Europe and America, and that's very often linked to the livestock industry, as well as finding new kind of vector-borne diseases. So I'm going to first of all talk about HIV, just to go through an example of the how these diseases spill over. And I'm going to lean very heavily from this very good book, which I highly recommend, called The Origin of AIDS. It's just in its second edition now. Now, there's actually other books with the same title, unhelpfully. So if you're going to read it, make sure it's this one by Jacques Pepin. And he brilliantly talks about the historical and kind of medical history of how HIV spilled over. And we focus a lot on the epidemic from the 1980s onwards, but how did it actually spill over from animal populations? So here on the right is a map of West Africa with the chimpanzee populations superimposed. And it's within this area of West Africa that we know SIV, which was a virus found in chimpanzees and other monkeys, etc., spilled over into humans. So I'm not going to go through this diagram. The key thing is we know we can track this through the genetics. We know where HIV came from. We even know through molecular clocks when it spilled over. And the key thing is it's happened many times. So there's a good quote here from the book. We know that over several decades, a cross-species transmission occurred at least four times for HIV-1, once for each group M, N, O, and P, each of which is thought to reflect distinct cross-species transmission events. And the key thing about this is, thus the epidemic of HIV-1 group M was triggered not because a lot of humans were infected directly from chimpanzees, but because a rare case of infection managed to spread and multiply, something which all the others that preceded had not managed to do. And this is an important point because we can tell that SIV has probably been crossing over into human populations for a very long time. What it didn't do, though, is then become a local epidemic or a global pandemic. So that's something to do with the way we as humans have been going into those environments and how human society has been changing. So molecular clocks show HIV-1 emerged in the 1920s in West Africa, Cameroon and the Congo. So what was happening in the region then? And Pepin very clearly shows that this was a situation where societies were in rapid transition. So this is kind of a chronotone, like I was talking about, from they're being changed by brutal European colonialism. So there was this process of intrusions into the world where in World War One, you had in this specific area with a very high number of chimpanzees, where we know actually from cross-referencing the virus in chimpanzees with that found in people, that this is where the spillover happened. We know that was about 1,700 in a military patrol, and they're having to live partly off bushmeat. And these were Cameroonian soldiers who were forcefully put into the military, for European military, and then terribly malnourished and having to live off bushmeat in an environment where previously only a very small number of hunters had been hunting wildlife. Here, suddenly, you got a very large number of people going to a biodiverse area and need to live off bushmeat to survive because of their brutal conditions. And at the same period, we have railway construction crossing the dense and hilly equatorial rainforest of Mayombe, the area we're talking about. 127,000 locals were forcefully conscripted, so they did not have an option. This is effectively slavery under Belgian colonialism. And 15,000 to 23,000 of these died in the process of building the railway between 1921 and 1934. And it's among these populations that we start to see disease which looks very much like what would become HIV. And the mortality in the Mayombe workers at one point was 496 per 1,000 in 1926. So who are these people? These are people who have been forced out of their communities, forced to do labouring for European colonialism, deep in the rainforest, surrounded by wildlife, which was carrying these pathogens, deeply malnourished, living in very crowded situations, and mostly male. And as a disease ecologist, if I was kind of wanted to invent a situation which was almost guaranteed to create a good spillover event, this would be it. Surround malnourished, crowded populations with highly biodiverse forest and make them mostly male, which means people are going to continue having sex, obviously. So when they are both there and when they return to town, you're going to see amplification of that disease. So we know that it kind of spilled over HIV in this area, and as it done many times before, but these unique situation under European colonialism meant that SIV could go from being a local concern to a regional epidemic and then a global pandemic. And this especially happens because we had increasing human density, travel and mixing, just the kind of things we're thinking about now with COVID-19, where we saw these kind of rapid changes in society happening in West Africa at the time. So Central African colonial cities have been quoted as created by Europeans but populated by Africans. And the lifestyles changed dramatically. Once again, they were majoritively male. There was people working as sex workers in this environment, and that's going to be a situation which is very much going to amplify any sexually transmitted disease. So the combination of this new urban setting with these intrusions into the wild of really brutal European colonialism is the setting in which HIV moved over into humans. And by 2019, 32.7 million people have died from AIDS. And when we think about AIDS deaths, we very, very often don't think back to the cause of this. And the original cause is this brutal intrusion into the forest by European colonialism and the social conditions created under it. So a more recent example is going to be Ebola. And in fact, there's occasional Ebola outbreaks happening in Africa in the last few decades. One has just been practically declared ended last week. And this is a graphic from the American Center for Disease Control. And it's a good graphic in many ways, but also it has some limitations, which I'll talk about. So you've got on the left, you can see that Ebola was a disease which is circulating in bats to and from various wild animals. And then you've got somebody in the middle in this image, kind of carrying a monkey of some kind, collecting bushmeat. That's the spillover event that's illustrated. And then the amplification that happened, the process by which it went from being a small spillover event to being a local epidemic, is linked to these human social relations. So the work, traditional funeral practices, unprotected healthcare workers, and contact with contaminated blood and body fluids. And it's nice at the end, we've got like a survivor, and we are seeing people survive from Ebola, especially now with kind of rapid interventions. So there's some real truth to this image, but also there's something fundamentally missing. So if we know that these diseases do spill over with kind of bushmeat and localized hunting occasionally, we also know they don't historically seem to become epidemics. So what is causing these Ebola outbreaks in Africa at the moment? And the missing thing is actually why that bushmeat is being eaten. So here's some forest cover maps and the locations of the first infection events in Europe in some of the recent outbreaks. And you can kind of see this in dense green forest. And but actually, you know, if we look more closely at the forests, we can start to see these are becoming heavily fragmented. So this dense forest in 2000, by 2014, it's become a lot more fragmented. And this could be for a number of reasons. It could be, as that kind of previous cartoon I just showed maybe indicate maybe because local people are living nearer the forest. Actually, some good data was done, mapping work was done, which showed that in this period, the distance between the forest edge and human communities has actually increased. So local people are actually further away from this kind of ecotone, this forest edge, than they were previously. So what is causing this fragmentation? And the answer is largely commercial logging. So what's going on in this environment is you're seeing the intrusion of commercial logging for global commodity demands, fragmenting the forest quite far away from settled local populations, and bushmeat is being hunted and other contact with wild animals is happening largely by those people working in that forest or moving those logs out of those forests along logging roads. So there's a quote from the article: by reshaping forest boundaries, altering habitat and reducing biodiversity, the growing global pressure on the land and its products is increasing the risk of zoonotic infections with important impacts on human health worldwide. So the CDC image we saw very much kind of identifies a local process as though it's somehow disconnected from the global capitalist system, but actually it's global commodity demands which are driving the fragmentation of this forest in a very similar way to we saw with HIV nearly 100 years ago. So that starts to explain some of the kind of red that we see in Africa and some of the patterns by which we see disease spillover happening. But disease spillover isn't just something that happens from forests to kind of the wider society. In fact, there's still obviously many indigenous populations, and I work with some in Papua New Guinea, who are living in remote areas who themselves are at risk of disease spillover from our crowded civilizations. We have many diseases which are a mortal threat to some of these populations, especially uncontacted peoples. And here's actually a picture of some uncontacted peoples, uncontacted because they've tried to remain uncontacted because the threat is from loggers, etc., in Brazil. And the Brazilian government for many years tried to create a process of controlled contact with the outside world for indigenous people. And one guy ran it, Sidney Fissolo, former FUNAI head, who ran this. And he said in his very good book called Die If You Must about his patrols, he said, "I believed it would be possible to make contact with no pain or deaths. I organized one of the best equipped fronts that FUNAI ever had. I prepared everything. I set up a system with doctors and nurses. I stocked with medicines to combat the epidemics, which always follow. I had vehicles, a helicopter, radios, and experienced personnel. I won't let a single Indian die," I thought. And the contact came, and the diseases arrived, and the Indians died. So this, we remember about disease spillover from forests to our crowded societies, but it's bi-directional. We are also spreading our diseases into these remote populations. In fact, that's happening now. I'm involved in a project to kind of work on trying to reduce COVID-19 spread in remote communities in Papua New Guinea, where it's a real threat. So this is something to remember when we're doing aid work in the global south, especially areas which have been relatively recently developed, that present and recent health patterns, especially in forest communities, are not somehow natural or solely as a result of the absence of medicine. In Papua New Guinea specifically, many populations were decimated by contact over the last 150 years, especially with smallpox outbreaks. And scabies, leprosy, tuberculosis, now HIV, and of course COVID-19, have been introduced from our crowded societies beyond the forest. And these colonial legacies kind of continue. So Papua New Guinea actually has some of the worst health metrics on Earth. But actually, many of these health metrics are related to diseases which have been introduced in the last 100 years. Now, I'm not claiming that these populations are living in a state of great health otherwise. There are many diseases in these kind of settings, but actually many of the diseases were and continue to be to do with our society rather than their cultures and their environment. And we should remember that when we're doing interventions. So, starting to think now about interventions and the work we can do on the ground. So this is in Papua New Guinea. We have a massive amount of logging. The country is mostly forested still. 70% of the country is still covered in primary rainforest, but we can start to see these logging roads move in a big way. And when I see this picture, I see a kind of, you know, road going into the wilderness. You know, I'm thinking about disease spillover. I'm thinking about kind of habitat fragmentation. That's because I'm coming from outside. Actually, if I was at the end of that road at a remote village, I might be thinking something very different. And in fact, logging companies' offer of roads and income to forest communities can partly extinguish the remoteness that bars access to health services. So if I was living at the end of that road and I had no access to in-community care and my child was ill, you know, actually I'm going to welcome a road, I'm going to welcome a way to get out to a hospital, even while knowing what the health effects of kind of deforestation are on my environment and the place I live. So there's this potential trade-off there between people's desire for health in these remote settings and the preservation of nature and the health-related ecosystem services. However, if we link health service provision into forest conservation, then actually we can start to turn around this trade-off. And that's exactly what we've been doing in Papua New Guinea. So Surfaces is an interdisciplinary project where we're looking to both conserve forests and work with indigenous communities to improve their health. It's indigenous led in New Guinea. We're only working in communities which have explicitly asked for these interventions. And New Guinea is the third largest tropical rainforest on Earth. One quarter of the forests of PNG have been cleared or degraded, mostly by commercial logging, once again serving global commodity demands. It's not for domestic use, it's not about local behaviour. And Papua New Guinea health related indicators, as I say, are very bad. So we started in terms of, and I'll just take you through how we started and we're carrying on with this project, so you can hopefully understand how you could replicate it yourself if you want to work in similar circumstances. So it's in the Wenang area. It's quite a remote site, takes 4 or 5 hours drive down a logging road and then a couple of hours walk through the forest to get to the villages. And so we went along with a mobile health patrol. We went into some villages that were our partner communities, and this is the first time any doctor had been into this community in its history, actually. And we kind of assessed what problems they had medically, spoke to them about what their service requirements would be, and very much led in terms of our health planning by what those communities wanted. We asked them in individual interviews, individual clinical consultations, and we also set up focus groups of young women, separately from young men, separately from older men, separately from older women, so we could really understand the different needs of different parts of the population. And we developed a kind of protocol for this, which integrates clinical and rapid anthropological assessments. And those of you involved in aid work, if you're going to environments where there's no existing health data, although this protocol and toolkit was developed for Papua New Guinea, actually we've made the resources available online digitally, and you know they're useful probably for any of those kind of settings. We found a very high amount of skin disease, so just to give you an idea of what we problems we're seeing there, this is Tinea imbricata. This is a big fungal disease. The person has had this, the child's had this for most of their life, tropical ulcers and yaws, as well as scabies, etc. So we're now doing interventions directly to treat those skin conditions. And between 2019 and 2022, we've got a project where we first of all went in. That's us bringing our medical supplies, yeah, over the river, training the local community, empowering them to be able to treat themselves with trauma management, understand and treat malaria, and also evacuate population people when they get injured. And on top of that, we've now been building a clinic. So we've got a permanent nurse staff clinic there, which is controlled by an indigenous health committee. So it's not under the control of outside kind of state organizations or for that point ourselves. And this has been linked to an expansion of forest conservation. So communities there who have been offered logging in the past decided to preserve 10,000 hectares of forest. And they still had other forest which loggers wanted to move into. But this ability to have health services provided linked to conservation meant that they could decide to conserve a much larger area. So we've seen lots more conservation areas be declared directly linked to the introduction of this clinic. So this is really what the community said it needed to be able to preserve the forest, their home, which they want to, and turn away the money and the kind of logging roads provided by the companies. And we're evaluating now the effect on community health and also on biodiversity of this project. And that's mostly being carried out by my colleagues from the local communities who've been trained to carry out the kind of biological research there. So it's an integrated health and conservation project, and there's other projects worldwide like it. So I'm going to take you through a couple of examples. One in Borneo around the Gunung Palang National Park. This is 90,000 hectares of rainforest with orangutans. So once again, we're thinking about primates. And the threat, inverted commas, is there's 60,000 people around this, mostly very poor and with very little access to health. And people in that community are have historically had to take and be involved in what the government anyway would class as illegal logging, simply to earn the basic cash for things like childhood vaccinations. So a group called Health in Harmony went there and they carried out something which they called like radical listening, which sounds a bit funny, but really what they were doing is just speaking to the local community and seeing what aid that community wanted, you know, in a kind of real collaboration. So it's not outsiders coming in and telling them what the solution is going to be, but rather asking the community what they needed. And that community very clearly said once again that they wanted health services, and that if they had health services in the community, then they could stop illegal logging. And that's worked very successfully. There's issues, ethical issues with some of the ways it's, you could see it's being carried out, and I'll come back to that later. But results are encouraging. So as well as a massively improved health in the area, from camera traps, we can see that orangutan populations are, you know, improving. And also we can see the amount of forest that's being cut down has reduced, and the amount of forest regenerating is going up. So that's pretty good. We should always be a bit cynical about data when we see it from charities and NGOs, including ones I'm involved in, because we always have this kind of need in aid organisations to evidence that our interventions are working, and we should be really cynical about that, both with ourselves and others. So when I see graphs like that, you know, I'm already seeing a trend going down before the intervention. So, you know, I'm going to think, okay, how much effect is that intervention having? Now, from other data, we know this intervention has worked quite well, but I just want to flag up that these projects very much I'm behind them, you know, I support them, I'm involved in running one myself, but we always want to be critical to what, you know, looks too good sometimes. So another example around this issue of disease and deforestation is it's not just about zoonotics, it's about more common, for instance, childhood health problems. So I'm not going to go into this in detail, but the key thing is somebody did a very good project in Cambodia where they looked at the effect of different forest cover on various diseases. And effectively on this chart, if things are to the right, if lines are to the right and they're not touching that line, that means that there's a relationship which shows that the disease has decreased with the condition. And what we see is with dense forest loss, we see an increase in various diseases. Specifically, we're looking at diarrhea. And that if diarrhea might not seem a very serious thing for those of us in the global north, but any of you who are involved in aid work on the ground, dealing with childhood diarrhea is a real issue and causes a large amount of mortality. Similarly, is the true with acute respiratory infections. Whereas areas which were protected had forest upstream, you saw reduced diarrhea and also reduced acute respiratory infection. Now, to get these kind of big results, these are big results in terms of health impacts, we would have to spend a lot of money on building clinics, putting in doctors. Doctors and nurses are not cheap. You know, medicines are not cheap. And actually, it's a much cheaper way to help people is just to help them preserve their forest. And that's to say in this context true for these kind of background diseases as well as zoonotic disease. So now I'm going to mention something quickly about COVID-19. Now, COVID-19 emerged obviously about a year and a half ago. We still don't really know the full story behind both its spillover or its amplification, how it became big in Wuhan, etc. So I'm not going to pretend that we have the exact answer, but it has to be said that we've been expecting this to happen for a long time. So an organization called the Eco Health Alliance has even been working in China in the very bat populations where it's where we've now identified the variant most linked to the COVID, to SARS-CoV-2 in humans. Eco Health Alliance has been working there for nearly 10 years to identify pathogens which could spill over to humans. And we in fact saw, you know, SARS-1 in the past emerged as a result of the wildlife trade in China and Asia. So we knew that after SARS-1, we could expect more coronaviruses to happen. We knew they were probably going to be in that red area in Asia. And we also knew that their spread and amplification was probably going to be through wildlife markets. And the recent World Health Organization investigation on the ground is pretty much showing that what we expected to happen did happen. So in a way, we shouldn't be surprised about this at all. But there are now 3 million deaths as a result of COVID-19. And every one of these deaths should be understood really as an environmental effect. So rising COVID-19 death tolls are a consequence of the destruction and the deformation of nature by our industrial civilization. And if we want to prevent these future pandemics, we need to tackle the ecological crisis of which they are a symptom. Now, you know, there's actually some good signs that this is being taken up in some sense. So a couple of weeks ago, the World Health Organization released a call, which has already been adopted in quite a few countries, to close down live wild animal markets. As a preventative health measure, both to stop COVID-19 spillover of new variants between humans and animals, etc., both ways, but also to stop new emerging diseases. And so that's really heartening that we're starting to see some action at this kind of boundary around the wildlife trade. When we think of the wildlife animal trade, the image people often have is a kind of, once again, small markets, local bushmeat, etc. But just like that story wasn't really true with Ebola and HIV, these were not just local concerns, it's not true in this case. So the wildlife trade market is feeding global commodity demands once again. It's an international market. And much of it is not necessarily wild animals that have been taken out of wilderness, as it were. Very large amount of wildlife animals are now being bred in farms, both for meat and for fur. And these environments, very often mixed species environments, hugely host dense feeding cities rather than local communities. These are very much the processes, these supply chains through which we're seeing pandemic emergence. So I'm going to talk now about some evidence gaps, ethical issues and contradictions in terms of the interventions. And there's a paper which you can see, which is freely available on the internet, which is up there, where we discuss this in a bit more detail. So the first thing to do there is evidence gaps, really. And evidence is building on strong links between biodiversity and human health. We know the relationships clearly now, scientifically, between anthropogenic, human-caused landscape change and the emergence of disease. And we also know how protecting forests and wider ecosystems can protect human health. So the evidence is there about that. But evidence is somewhat lacking on whether this knowledge results actually in biodiversity conservation and increased health on the ground. So we're addressing this in Papua New Guinea. So we really want to see, okay, are our projects having a real impact over the long term? And we're also doing some global evidence mapping on that. And there's some similar issues with closures of industrial wildlife supply chains. So it's really positive that we've seen these supply chains close down since COVID-19. But it has to be said, many of these big industrial markets closed down after SARS-1 and then reopened. So, you know, there's a question about how long-term these kind of interventions are. And I think, you know, we need to make sure that we make them long-term. There's some ethical issues in relation to these integrated health and conservation projects. So first of all, conditionality of medical provision. Now, in our project in PNG, anyone who walks into the clinic can get treated just like they would be in, you know, the National Health Service in the UK, etc. However, in some projects, there are understandable reasons to do with resource constraint, but also because maybe it's more common in those countries to price for health services there is some kind of conditionality involved. And I think there's some real ethical problems with that, and we should be alert to it. We definitely shouldn't be in a situation where we're making Indigenous people exchange their forests to become national parks for health gains. That would be overtly oppressive. Our projects, and most all the projects I've talked about today, are very much collaborations with Indigenous people, but we have to be alert to that risk of effectively green colonialism. Now, there's an issue with unsustainably replacing traditional medicine. So if we go in and bring in kind of medical aid to these communities, are we going to disempower local healers? That's an issue we need to be aware of. The healers where we work in Papua New Guinea are directly involved in our project and have been trained to carry out some more biomedical interventions as well. And the fact is they don't have a traditional medical approach to dealing with diseases which only were introduced into their society 100 years ago anyway. So there's no traditional medicine in Papua New Guinea for HIV, for tuberculosis, for scabies, etc. There's an issue about being medical missionaries, and I think this is a more wider question for any of us involved in aid. Historically, a lot of health work in the global south has been carried out really by religious organizations who were exchanging medicine for recruitment into their church, and we shouldn't replicate that with even conservation or maybe even progressive developmental politics. We need to be careful about not becoming using medicine to spread our own ideas, as it were. And similarly, there's issues around medical volunteers from abroad. So there's a good quote here from a very good essay on this by Bao. It said, very often clinicians from the global north will go with the best heart in the world, go to the global south to help communities. However, they'll often operate beyond their normal scope of clinical practice. And effectively, they're usually quite junior. So they're using poor people in the third world as experimental fodder to improve their technical skills. This is not always the case by any means, but it's quite a common issue and definitely argues for training local people and supporting local development on top of our emergency interventions. And I've already mentioned issues around medical charging. The final thing I'll say is this is a major contradiction, and then I'll come to the summary, is I've very much been pushing this idea that we can kind of integrate the planetary health approach integrates conservation and health, working with Indigenous people, trying to preserve forests to stop zoonotic spillover. It's a very attractive idea that we can both have human health and biodiversity, but it may just be a Panglossian fantasy. You know, Panglossian fantasies are things which they're the best of all ideas and the best of all possible worlds, you know, and we should be really wary of things which we desperately want to believe. So in summary, wildlife health and human health are deeply connected. Industrial civilization supply chains are driving pathogen spillover and amplification, not simply local activities and traditional customs. So it's not the one hunter from the pygmies in the Congo or from, you know, the population in Wanang going into the forest and getting a monkey for their dinner. It's food chains supplying usually industrial intrusions into environments. That's what enables these occasional spillovers to become epidemics and outbreaks and pandemics. Spillover is bi-directional. So increasingly, especially in the context of this pandemic, we're hearing a lot about diseases spilling out forests of the wildlife trade, the idea that the wildlife and maybe these dark forests are a place of threat. But let's remember that we're also spreading diseases from our crowded environments to the Indigenous peoples which live in these forests, and also to the threatened animals that live in them too. Human health concerns are a threat to tropical rainforests and wildlife for the reason I've said, but they're also a potential opportunity for conservation and support of Indigenous health. And where we can get that kind of synergy operating, it can be really successful. Prevention through forest protection and tackling the wildlife trade is much better and cheaper than cure. And we need to move away from a medical system which is entirely based on doctors and nurses to be thinking about water and sanitation, for instance, you know, as many, I'm sure, of the listeners are involved in. That water and sanitation is not just about engineering, but also about ecosystem preservation. Small aid organisations are working effectively with Indigenous groups with local and global gains for health and conservation. I've given you a couple of examples, but actually there's about 40 or 50 projects globally operating like this. So get involved if you're interested in this area. And planetary health is a vibrant medical movement. It's just, we've just had our global conference last week with hundreds of organizations and peoples involved. It was based in Brazil, but obviously organized online this time. It's an expanding scientific field, and it's also, I would say, a beautiful idea to think about protecting human health by protecting the natural systems which underpin it. But we must be vigilant and remain cynical to ideas which we really want to be true. So, you know, as we carry out these interventions, we need to evaluate them and make sure we're really having the impact we want to see for both Indigenous health, global health, and conservation. So in conclusion, I'm going to say, you know, the present moment is unique for me in maybe my lifetime in terms of a global pandemic, but it's actually just a sign of many things to come. And let's seize the opportunity of a mass zoonotic pandemic emanating from the wildlife trade to protect wildlife populations, tropical forests, and Indigenous health. Thank you.
Thank you, Joe, for this really interesting and insightful talk. It's great to hear for me also, like, because I'm also coming from the humanitarian field, it's great to hear that there's a project really looking at the needs of communities, trying to find out the needs and also really looking at the impact. And we do have some questions from the chat, and one of the questions is actually if you found out any other needs of these communities apart from better healthcare or stopping deforestation. So yeah, did you come across any other needs that could be somehow met?
Yeah, so the project in Wenang, which is the one I was talking about, is we've been involved in there for quite a while, actually, 15 years. And one of the first things the community asked for, when I talk about the community, we've got a population there of 250 in the main village and 2,000 being served by the health post. But it's quite a remote area with a very low population density. And when we had meetings with the whole community, and they discussed what they wanted. One thing they definitely wanted was schools, but and so schools have been built in those communities, which are controlled once again by committees of the villages. And, you know, and schools and medical clinics actually are one of the main ways by which states build up themselves in remote local communities. That's true in the entire post-colonial period, and arguably somewhat less so, but still in the colonial period. And obviously the state is not necessarily the best protector of Indigenous people. Often it's the threat to them. It's hand in glove with logging companies, with mining companies, etc. So it's important, whether it's schooling or whether it's healthcare or any of the other services that communities want, that they remain very much autonomously under the control of people on the ground and don't become some form of seed for the expansion of state power. And so they've asked for schools, and they've got schools. They've asked for a clinic. They've asked for training in healthcare, which they've got. And they've also been trained a lot to carry out the kind of biological monitoring of their forests. So they run the conservation area. 97% of land in Papua New Guinea is owned communally by tribes. So there's almost no individual private property of land in Papua New Guinea. This is unique, and I think a major success for the peoples there. And they're always having to fight off the privatization of land, but they are standing from quite a position of strength, and so they're very much in control. So in conclusion, I suppose we're talking schooling, training as parataxonomists, transport into town when they need it, and our partners provide that. But the main thing that they really want to do, the foundation of it, is to carry on living the way they do live in the forest, not having to allow the forest to be logged, but getting some of the benefits that you can get from industrial society, such as biomedicine.
Okay, great. And seems you've inspired the audience. So now there's two more questions about what we as individuals can do. So the first question is, what should I avoid buying to not contribute to the pressure on the indigenous peoples you talked about? And the second question is, what organization can I give money to most effectively support biodiversity and global health at the same time?
Okay, so the first question, I think we have to be realistic, really. The situation is that the deforestation, for instance, that's happening in Papua New Guinea, this is mostly it's almost entirely for export. It's going into industrial Asia, but actually it's very often then an industrial product that's also coming to the West. And it's difficult, obviously, I tell you, don't buy tropical logs from Papua New Guinea, but you're very unlikely to be doing that anyway. The reality is that as long as we have a global industrial system which is going into these wild areas and looking to turn living systems into money, we're going to see destruction, and probably individual consumerism won't fix that. Probably what needs, where best can be helped, is supporting indigenous communities who are to defend their land against outside corporations. And I know that's not a quick fix, and it's not as easy as kind of maybe ethical consumerism, but I think within this context, for those of us very far away from the forest, that's probably what we can do. And I would say, in terms of supporting global health and also indigenous health and conservation, I would say there are numerous organizations out there who are doing this work. One very good organization is called Health in Harmony. I'm not actually connected to them in any way, so I'm not hyping my own organization, as it were. But actually, mostly I think it's about supporting local indigenous communities. And they are organized in their own NGOs. They don't need kind of us in the global north to be setting up structures for them. Many of these local groups can be reached through Survival International. And that's true both for kind of forest dwelling populations in Africa and in New Guinea and Asia.
Okay, thank you. Then there's a question, how are you dealing with COVID at the health posts right now? So I guess the question is also how does that affect the work on the ground at the moment?
So in Papua New Guinea was doing excellently, actually, in relation to COVID. Now I'm based in Britain. I'm over in Papua New Guinea quite regularly, but I've been based in Britain and involved in public health. And I think it's fair to say Britain has been nearly winning the competition for the worst medical response to a pandemic you could have in the country. You know, it's a hard competition. There's many competitors, but we've done quite badly. We've had 150,000 deaths, and we've got 60 million people. Papua New Guinea has 7 million people, so a smaller population. But until February, they'd only had 600 cases and 20 deaths. And the reason for this is they very quickly put in quarantining at borders. Actually, in March last year, we've only just started it in the UK now. And that quarantining kind of supported Papua New Guineans in quarantine for 14 days to check whether they had any symptoms, and did a very good job of stopping introduction of SARS-CoV-2 into PNG. Where it has been introduced, it's been introduced largely by mining company workers who've been allowed, and politicians and the military have been exempted from some of these quarantining. And that maybe unfortunately happened a bit more this spring. So in February, I said we had 600 cases in a year. Between February and now, we have 10,500 cases, and the testing regime is pretty good in some of the cities, but in remote areas, it's non-existent. So SARS-CoV-2 is probably going to escalate to be a major threat in Papua New Guinea. At the moment, it hasn't actually got to the communities we're working in. The capital of Papua New Guinea, Port Moresby, has no road which connects it to any significant of any other towns. Most of the population are in remote rural areas, so it's not the kind of highly connected society that we have, and that's going to be protective. But when SARS-CoV-2 comes to some of the communities, it's likely to be devastating. Now, there's the age of the communities is on average much lower than, you know, in the UK. So there's not going to be lots of people over 80 dying, because there aren't many people over 80. But there is malnourished people, there is people with other infections, especially tuberculosis. So we're expecting a significant mortality across Papua New Guinea if the outbreak is allowed to spread thoroughly. But so far, it's not been too bad. But it's going to be a long issue. And I think when we've almost forgotten about it in the global north, it's still going to be tearing apart lots of communities in the unvaccinated global south.
Talking about vaccines, there's a question, what is important now to help indigenous populations with COVID, and what's your position on waiving COVID vaccine patents? So that refers to the TRIPS waiver. I'm not sure if you've heard of that.
Yeah. Well, my personal position is that patents are always theft. You know, that's a straightforward way of controlling innovation, knowledge, you know, and so that's been true. That's universally true. But within the context of medicine, it's a real killer. So many of the people, I talked about HIV earlier, and I said that, you know, around 30 million people have died from AIDS, and every one of those is in a sense an environmental effect from that initial intrusion. But many of those millions died when HIV medications were well developed on the market and available in the global north, and not available at any reasonable price in the global south. And it took a significant mass movement, really, by people, especially in South Africa, but worldwide, against those patents, and also clinicians as well, to move HIV drugs to being widely available in the global south and under $5 a day. So the same thing is going on now, really, with this struggle to stop the patents on vaccines. And I obviously think that vaccines should be available for all. The vaccine, the TRIPS negotiation at the moment, it's really good that it looks like that may win, that the patent on some aspects of the vaccines will be removed. But there is opposition, obviously, from some European countries on that. However, even if that's won, that doesn't really mean that the patents on the vaccines are not present. There's still patents on the technologies, on the parts of that vaccine development. And actually, lots of our drugs, lots of our vaccines are produced for us in the global south, especially India. And the global south has the capacity to generate these vaccines if there's not a barrier put up against their production. So that's what I'd say. And I think indigenous communities are really at definite need of these vaccines, especially in places like Brazil, where we know there's a significant outbreak going on, and there's co-infections with tuberculosis and COVID-19, even in quite remote communities.
We have a few more questions regarding the biology behind that. You talked before about that certain animals are in danger of being culled because of outbreaks. I'm not sure our old audience knows what the term culled really means, what that means. And can you talk a little bit about the relation between wild animals and livestock? Can you say anything about that?
Yeah. So the first thing to bear in mind, just going back to what I said in the talk, is that when we change wild habitats to be human dominated, the kind of species that continue to live in those dominated landscapes, you can predict what they're going to be. They're not going to be large animals usually, because we hunt them, or they just don't tolerate being in close proximity to humans. So disproportionately in human dominated landscapes, you're going to get a kind of community of animals which are usually quite small, like rodents and bats, and not just small, but but they kind of tolerate human activity. And those animals, they invest a lot in reproduction, so they have lots of babies. They don't live very long. So unlike large animals, which invest a lot in immunity and live longer and have less babies, these smaller animals, they really, rodents especially, they are likely to carry a high number of pathogens, including pathogens which could spill over to humans. And the context of Nipah and also probably COVID-19 was that these pathogens originated in bats. And in fact, bats are one of the few wild populations which can tolerate living in kind of human dominated landscapes. You know, they're mobile, they travel around at night largely, so they're less under threat of people. And so I think, you know, we know from Nipah that the disease there, which was in Asia and 10, 15 years ago, that spread when agriculture was going into forests, mango farms, in fact, among other things, with pigs being farmed underneath the mango trees. The bats were coming in, roosting in the trees, shitting onto the ground. That transferred into pigs. Pigs were kind of intermediate host, and then to humans. So very often, but not always, you get domestic animals being a kind of intermediary between these wild species and humans. Like with HIV, sometimes it's direct, but very often it is through domestic animals.
Okay. And so we've been hearing now lots of examples from Asia and Africa, and we're sitting here in Europe, and I'm wondering, so can we say, oh, we're fine here, this is all happening far away, or are like certain changes in the environment, can they also be expected to have more health effects in the future in Europe?
Yes. Yeah, so actually, obviously the talk was on forests and, you know, indigenous health, but actually the same processes are underway worldwide. The difference really between what we're seeing in the globe in Europe and what's happening in New Guinea is in Europe, in Britain, we've got a very small amount of forest, a very small amount of, primary habitats left. So the process is simply more advanced here. But it's still the same process. And actually, I work on, so there's two areas of diseases which are expanding in the global north, or at least that we know about. And one is these diseases which are really spilling out of factory farming. So we're using some of the same antibiotics as a growth to provide growth of animals in factory farming, that we use the same antibiotics for diseases in humans. So we're starting to see significant antimicrobial resistance developing in livestock. So if you remember back to the map I showed during the talk, actually, like, yes, there was red in India and red across parts of Africa, but there was quite a lot of red in Northern Europe too, and in America. And that's mostly to do with the livestock industry. It's also to do with immunocompromise. So if you think about COVID-19 in the UK, I'm afraid we had a variant of SARS-CoV-2, which is developed in Kent in southeast England. And that's now spreading, unfortunately, across large amounts of Europe and is more transmittable than the previously dominant strain. And that we know developed in immunocompromised elderly in Kent. So actually the age structure of our populations and the fact that they don't have a very strong immune system itself becomes a place where these pathogens can develop. So we're not outside as humans, we're not outside these ecological system, we're also part of the space where these pathogens are developing. And the other way we see some of these processes happening in the global north is, I suppose, around vector-borne diseases. With climate change, we're aware that we're seeing diseases moving north, but actually there's quite a few vector-borne diseases vectored by ticks, which are being identified in Europe. And I know in Germany you have Lyme disease, I don't know what it's called in German, but we also have it actually here. And I've done studies on tick-borne diseases, which are increasing. And there's some good work which shows that, once again, forest fragmentation creates a situation which puts more people in contact with forest edge and creates smaller forest fragments in both Europe and America. Smaller forest fragments which are biased towards these kind of rodents, small mammals, which carry the Lyme borreliosis pathogen and also tolerate having a large amount of ticks. So in one of these kind of forest fragments in where I live in the South Downs in England, but also across Germany, Netherlands, Eastern United States, in one of these forest fragments, you're much more likely to be bitten by a tick which is carrying a pathogen than a larger contiguous area of forest, which is more biodiverse, where there are other hosts the ticks could feed from, hosts which are unlikely to be carrying the pathogen. So these processes are underway here, but the key thing I suppose to think about is that the disease emergence from places like Asia, equatorial Africa, they're very far away, but they're implicitly connected to the commodity changes we ourselves live on. So there's no real distance in these supply chains. We're connected to those places intimately, even if we'll never go to them.
So there's one last question. Thinking long term, how much of Earth's landmass have to be converted back to protected wildlife areas in order to find a balance for our ecosystem again?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. So, I'm not going to know a number or pretend to know a number, but what I would say is that there's obviously these this year there's a push, including by some governments, to make kind of to make new global policies for the expansion of conservation areas. So there's an idea of getting maybe 30% of the global landmass to be protected areas for conservation. Now, there's good things and bad things about that. One of the major things to remember is, obviously, governments like to have big conferences where they make promises, and then this very rarely turns into anything. We know this from climate change. I was at the Berlin Climate Change Conference in 1995, which was the precursor of the present climate change conferences. And it was obvious even then that no real change was going to happen at a global level from governments. So there is a push to kind of preserve increased landscapes from governments, but how much that will turn into reality, I doubt. The key thing, I think, is supporting those communities on the ground which want to preserve their forest. And we're living in a pretty terrible time in terms of biological annihilation of living systems. And there's relatively few people who are willing to do anything about it. And this can seem a bit depressing, but actually it's a good thing in a sense, because actually if there's a very large amount of problems in many places, many threats, many habitats being destroyed, in some of those places, you're going to find communities which really want to defend them. And most of those places, you're never going to reach. So one might as well just choose those places with the least ethical problems, where there are communities themselves who want to preserve the land, and work with those communities. So I'd start, rather than thinking what percentage do we need to preserve globally, I'd start from the basic level of thinking, let's go out and find people, build solidarity, find allies who want to work with us to preserve land. And there's a lot of indigenous communities who want to do that. There's many people who don't, and we can choose to work with those who do. And that reciprocal relationship can have benefits for health globally, locally, as well as conservation. And that's where I'd start from. So I'm afraid that's definitely, I would say, avoiding the answer to a certain extent, but it's more the way I have to think.
Thank you. Well, I'm very much in favor of a call for solidarity and really looking at the social effects of everything. Joe, thank you very much for your talk and that you were here. It was really, really interesting and great to hear about the projects in PNG, and good luck with that. And thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Okay, and thank you to our streaming technicians in the background, and everyone at home at the screens. Thank you for watching and for asking so many interesting questions, and have a good evening and see you next time. Bye-bye.